Hi guys, Joy here. Just a note about today's show. We had some sound quality issues with our interview, so we put it last in the episode. If you get there and it bothers you, it's the end. You can just skip it. Thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Joy Manning, editor of Edible Philly.
And I'm Marisa McClellan, author of Food in Jars.
Welcome to Local Mouthful. We're here to talk about living the food life in Philadelphia and beyond. This week, we're chatting about tacos, olive oil, and the wonderful world of tea with Alexis Siemens of the wonderful blog Teaspoons and Petals. But first, let's compare notes on something we read this week. I noticed a story in our own Philadelphia Inquirer that boldly said that cabbage is the new kale. Agree or disagree?
Well, I feel like it's hard for cabbage to be the new kale because cabbage has been sort of a mainstay. I don't feel like it's gone anywhere. But I love all the things people are doing with cabbage.
Some of the ways that they mentioned in the story that local chefs have been using it are smoking it. Haven't done that, but I bet it's very delicious. Fermenting. We've talked a lot about that.
We're both kraut fans.
Slow cooking it for 12 hours, braising it, stuffing it, and using it in salad. What are some ways that you like to cook with cabbage at
home? I'm a big fan of I use cabbage all winter long. It's one of my favorite vegetables because it's good for you and it's very high in fiber and it keeps in the refrigerator for an age. So I actually try to always have a head of cabbage or at least half a cabbage tucked in my crisper drawer because I know that if nothing else is around, at least I'll have cabbage, which is really handy.
That's so true. Even when you cut it, and have you noticed this? Sometimes it will get a little skanky and brown on the outside, but you can just trim it away.
Yep. I know. I love it. It is definitely one of my staple vegetables, especially this time of year. But one of my very favorite things to do is to add it to soup at the end, sort of like almost like a noodle. Often my husband is avoiding carbs, and I probably should be as well. But so I'll make big batches of chicken soup, and what I do is, you know, all the, you know, aromatics and everything. But then towards the end, I'll finally shred up 3 or 4 cups of cabbage and stir it in. And it sort of dissolves, but it gives the soup the same sort of bulk that you get from adding a handful of noodles at the end, but without the sort of diet-busting carb factor. And so it really makes it so hearty and good.
I love cabbage in soup.
Yeah, it's really delicious.
When you use it in a salad, mm-hmm. Do you use it in salads?
I do.
Is there anything that you do to it to sort of take an edge off the rawness?
Well, I will sometimes salt it before I add it to a salad. So, you know, not like a fermentation salting, but a couple pinches of kosher salt and let it sit for 10 or 15 minutes just to kind of help break it down a little bit so that it's not so aggressively crunchy.
I do that as well, except I salt it really aggressively.
Do you?
And then this is sort of more so if I wouldn't have a bag of shredded cabbage in the fridge just to throw into salad or use for whatever. I salt it really heavily and then I rinse it and sort of squeeze it out and put it in a bag. And I think that the salt not only softens it a little, but it also, even if after it's rinsed off, I think it makes it stay fresh longer.
Yeah. I also really love to just use cabbage in a stir fry. So if I'm making, you know, like a stir-fried broccoli thing for dinner and I need extra bulk, you can add a lot of cabbage to that. And it gets sort of caramelized and browned on the edges when you're doing it in a big pan on high heat, sort of getting everything moving. And so you get that really nice sort of char and tender crisp aspect from it that I love.
Lately, I've been cutting it up into wedges and just roasting it on high heat for kind of a long time until the exterior gets almost crispy like a kale chip or something and the inside is very sweet and tender. Is that
I love that too. I years ago actually, it's got to be four or five years ago now, I wrote an article for Grid Philly about new ways to use cabbage, and one of the ways was to cut it into rounds and just brush it with a little olive oil and roast it until it was sort of crisp on the outside. And it's really good to just plop an egg on top of that. I love that.
Cabbage and eggs are best friends.
So good.
I feel like we've talked about this before.
Exactly. The scrambled egg, the tons of sautéed cabbage, a little soy sauce.
Garlic, ginger, and scallions.
And then working that scrambled egg into it. Oh, my God. That's so good and so filling.
And almost every day since I have gotten on this fermentation kick, I've been having eggs and kraut in the morning.
So good. My other favorite one is avocado toast, which we all know is all the rage, with healthy scoops of kraut on top. So a kraut and avocado toast.
It's I haven't tried it that way.
It's really good.
I know kraut is super good with anything that's like fatty and rich, I find. It's pickly. It cuts through that. Mm-hmm. It's a great compliment.
Well, oh, cabbage. I love it.
Yeah, I mean, we could probably talk about cabbage for it's a true. While.
Although I feel like, too, it's my, you know, my Eastern European roots.
But should we talk should we talk about what's for dinner this week?
Other than cabbage.
Well, I mean, there might be some cabbage on the plate here, too. But what about tacos? Do you make tacos at home?
I do. I love tacos. I do tacos. And then, again, when we're sort of eating lower carb, I'll do a lot of taco salads. Mm-hmm. So, you know, make all of the traditional taco toppings and then put them on a big bowl of salad greens or chopped cabbage.
Sometimes I do that, too. And Dan will have the regular taco and I will have a taco salad. What types of fillings do you like for your tacos?
I really like – I have a couple sort of go-tos. One is that I'll just do chicken breast cut up real fine and then marinated in a little lemon juice, cumin, and some like just a pinch of cayenne to make it a little bit hot and smoky. And then I'll just cook that real fast so we have little chicken strips. Or my other favorite is ground turkey, which sounds sort of unsexy, but is so good when you saute it. Just brown it with like some lime juice and lime zest and cilantro and again cumin and then maybe some red chili flakes. And it gets sort of juicy and tangy and, you know, meaty. It's really a good one.
I rarely use either of those things for tacos. My major go-tos are, of course, pulled pork or chicken tinga, which is braised chicken thighs in a oniony, tomato-y, chipotle-ish sauce. Both of those things freeze like indefinitely. Yeah. And so I like to put little packets of them in the freezer. And I also put my tortillas in packs of like 10 in the freezer so that I can have like almost an instant taco dinner. Yeah. You know, sort of like my way with pizza. So that's always there for me when I need it.
That sounds good.
Did you ever make tortillas?
I have made tortillas a couple of times, both to not great success. And I think it's my own fault. I remember years ago I worked as a personal assistant for this woman who had a Mexican – she was – the woman who I worked for was from Latin America somewhere and spoke Spanish and English. But she had a Mexican maid who didn't speak any English. And so she would communicate with her and then, you know, we'd sort of pretend to communicate. But I would watch her make tortillas. She made fresh tortillas every week. But, of course, she couldn't tell me – how she was doing it or what to do because she didn't speak English and my high school Spanish was
not up to the task,
far long gone by that point. And but I just remember watching her, and so a couple times I tried to do it on my own and it was never the same.
I have tried to do it on my own too, and I also didn't get great results. But there is that Tortilleria San Roman on the Italian market.
Those tortillas are so good.
I try to stock up
and
put them in the freezer, of course.
Yeah, I often have some of those whenever I go to the Italian market. Also, their tortilla chips are dangerous, deadly.
Yeah, I almost never buy them. Unless I'm having people over or bringing them somewhere. I love those. Can we talk about radishes and tacos?
Yeah, absolutely.
Before we run out of taco time. You know how when you get tacos from a taqueria, you always get these slices of radishes that are like coins?
Mm-hmm.
One time I was at one of the fancier Mexican places. I think it might have been Jose Garza's Distrito. Mm-hmm. And I noticed that they cut their radishes up into matchsticks.
Yes.
And whereas I would take the sliced radishes and throw them in the trash, once they became matchsticks, I was like, this is an essential taco topping. And now when I make them at home or even when I get those formerly garbage-bound coins, I cut them into matchsticks. Do you like radishes on your tacos?
I do, and I almost always have a little jar of pickled radishes in my fridge, so I'll often, if I'm doing homemade tacos, reach for the pickled radishes because they add that little bit of crunch and zing.
But and do you cut them into matchsticks, or how do you...
I think probably I just there. I think I have them in coins, and so I just fork a few out onto the you know whatever I'm eating. But I think that matchsticks are more fun.
I don't know. It's just one of the. This has happened to me in other foods, but there's something about like slicing it a little different that just makes all the difference. And suddenly, something that you didn't like becomes something that you must have.
Yeah,
and that really happened to me. It's now like a must-have.
So, Joy, now that you're into fermenting too, you need to start applying your fermented things to your tacos.
I know. Well, radishes have been on my list of things to ferment. I haven't gotten to
it yet. They're so easy. It's the easiest one.
Really?
Yeah.
Honestly, like, the big fermenting kick is directly related to my CSA. Uh-huh. I've been just fermenting all the excess CSA stuff. But I do – that's big on my list, as well as shallots. And then I think this is a cousin of sauerkraut. It's called cordito.
Uh-huh.
I think that would be – this cordito is a – I think a Latin American type of cabbage ferment that has maybe cumin and something spicy
in
it.
Yeah, and often carrots and – yeah.
I need to make some of that. That would be an incredible taco topping.
I will confess too, and I know this is actually hip in some areas – that the kimchi taco is a delicious, delicious item. So if you ever find yourself with some kimchi and you're making tacos.
I haven't tackled kimchi either.
You know what? Kimchi to me, I've tried it a couple times and it's never been as good as I wanted it to be. Mm. So I still go to one of the big Asian grocery stores in South Philly and buy a big jar for $5. And it lasts forever and it's so good. And I just can't get mine as good as that. And so,
Do you get it in the refrigerated section?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm just wondering. In the refrigerated section. The Asian grocery store at like 6th and Washington carries a really good one that I like.
Because I want my probiotics,
yeah.
You know, out of that.
I know. You've got to, it's got to be gut friendly. All right. I love tacos. I could talk about tacos all day, but instead, we're going to talk about olive oil for a little while. So this is the first installment in our occasional ongoing series about cooking oils or cooking fats, because I feel like we all default sometimes to particular cooking fats, and it's nice to hear about others and talk about others and, you know, just see what else is out there.
It's such a big topic.
It is a big topic, and everybody, you know, it's like, is, you know, butter was the demon for a while, and now it's back, and, you know.
There's so much to cover. I'm glad we're going to focus on one particular fat today.
And so today we're going to talk about olive oil, and now I am no expert in olive oil. I did go to an olive oil tasting earlier this year and learned a little something about olive oils and, you know, what you're looking for when you're tasting them and the ones you want to use for cooking versus, you know, drizzling on top of things. One of the most interesting things I learned is that green grassy color that we look for in olive oil, thinking that that's a sign of sort of quality or, you know, purity or extra virgininess, is not actually a true marker. That's actually something less trustworthy olive oil producers will add the chlorophyll to their olive oil to make it greener because we think that that's a marker of quality.
Sneaky.
Yeah, seriously. But so.
Is olive oil your primary cooking oil?
I use olive oil and coconut oil pretty interchangeably. I do use butter when I'm cooking eggs because it tastes good. But yeah, I typically default to olive oil.
I buy olive oil in a huge, I can't think of how many ounces, but it's a large tin that I get on the Italian market.
Uh-huh.
And then I pour it into like this old wine bottle that we have with like a little spout.
Yeah.
And I use olive oil. I definitely use it every day. It's totally my default cooking oil.
Yeah.
And mostly because of the health benefits.
Yeah, it's really good for you. I used to buy it from the Italian market. A couple years ago, we joined Costco. And so they have really good tasting olive oil, organic olive oil in big bottles. And I do something similar.
From where?
It's Italian organic olive oil. And I did some research and it is actually a legitimate, you know, not tampered with olive oil. Costco is actually typically pretty good about vetting their products.
Right.
And so it is an extra virgin olive oil. And it is fairly green and grassy, but not so much. But again, that doesn't tell you anything. Things you want to look out for are, you know, when you see like virgin or pure versus extra virgin. Virgin olive oil is a term that they use in Italy, but isn't something that we actually get here in the U.S. much. And then pure has no meaning in the olive oil market. So it's good to be careful.
We'll talk about canola oil, on a later segment. But I feel safer with a pure olive oil than I do with canola oil.
Yeah, it just in terms of like pure, it doesn't have a meaning in terms extra virgin, or there's no like grade.
You're probably not going to get those incredible health benefits that we associate with olive oil from a pure olive oil, but I still think it's a good choice for a neutral tasting
True.
Oil.
True. And extra virgins can be really strongly flavored. And so it's good if you want to like bake with an olive oil to use something that's a little bit lighter in flavor. One of the things I learned when I went to this olive oil tasting is that if you get confused, there are some bodies out there that are certifying olive oils. The tasting I went to was put on by the California Olive Oil Council. And they have a little sticker, a label of certification. So it's a good – things like that.
What does this certification signify?
They go through a whole tasting process. So all of the olive oil producers in California who are part members submit their oil to them, and they have tasting panels that will taste for off flavors or, you know, different qualities or levels. And so they'll get, you know, some award will get awards, or they'll, you know, if it's not up to their standards, they won't be allowed to put one of the olive oil councils, the California Olive Oil Council's sticker on there, so that you just know that it's a marker of quality, which is helpful.
But it mostly has to do with flavor.
Flavor and quality. So if it has any sort of rancid, if it's gone bad or it's rancid or the mm-hmm. batch isn't good, one of the ways you tell is through flavor mm-hmm. and scent. And so often if it wasn't held correctly, gotten out of the light in it, so, or it was somehow
bad handling,
they'll taste it before it goes to market so that you know that you're not getting.
Does your your Costco olive oil is from Italy?
It's from Italy.
So this only applies to California.
Yeah,
olive
but
oil.
There are some Italian markers like that too, but the California one was useful, especially for people who are looking to buy domestically.
I have heard that you are more likely to have a fresher product if you buy from California
yeah.
as opposed to Italy or Spain.
True.
Although, aren't those places sort of equally far away from us here on the East Coast? I don't know. I still buy mostly Italian olive oil.
But I think in California, at least, it doesn't have to go through customs, which
True.
Can be a delay.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I'm not promoting the California Olive Oil Council, but for people who are really confused by olive oils out there, it's a good resource. And they will also – they have brands that they market on their own, and you can get like – they have a bold and peppery one, and they have a – so if you're looking for those flavors, it, you know, it's sort of a user-friendly guide to it. I also – I feel like this has been the year of olive oil. The folks at Bertolli –
What do you have there?
– sent me a big thing of their 150th anniversary
oh, wow.
olive oil this year.
Did you taste it yet?
I haven't tasted it yet because I didn't want to open it.
You guys can't see this, but the bottle is really elaborate and beautiful.
Yeah, it's pretty sexy. It's got this like, you know, voluptuous Italian lady.
Is she wearing a hat or like a neckerchief?
I think she's wearing some sort of headscarf.
Oh, we're going to need a photo of this.
But one of the things that's nice about this bottle, again, is that it's light. It's not going to let the light in. It's both tinted glass, and that's something you want to look
for. How have
you
resisted opening this?
I wanted to save it for and also, I've been meaning to write a blog post about the ways in which I use olive oil in preserving. You can't can with olive oil, but when I freeze things, I will often, like if I freeze pesto or I make like a long, slow roasted mm-hmm. tomato paste, I freeze them in small, like 4 ounce
with
jars
olive oil
with
on the
olive
top.
Oil on the top so they don't oxidize or get freezer burnt.
That bottle notwithstanding, do you keep a bottle around that is extra special for as a finishing oil?
I sometimes do. It depends. I have a teeny tiny can from California right mm-hmm. now of super sort of fresh, grassy, little bit peppery olive oil that I use like to drizzle over a salad when I'm making a big sort of just salad for myself for lunch or something.
Can I shout out my special
yeah,
favorite
absolutely.
Olive oil? It's Olio Verde from Sicily.
Ooh.
It is something like $50 a bottle. It's really a splurge, but it is so buttery and flavorful, and it just makes, especially things like salad,
yeah.
you know, it makes it so extra special that I can't say I always have a bottle, but I
yeah.
Maybe 2 times a year I buy it, and it's just, especially in the summer. I mean, I still have my bottle from the summer that I bought. It's just so great with raw salads. It's delicious, and as a finishing oil for anything like with pasta. I just love it.
Yeah, I do love those special oils too. If you're making like garlic toast or something where you've just toasted up some crusty bread and then rub some garlic cloves and then a little drizzle of those really fancy olive oils. Yum. It's so good.
It is a best friend to vegetables, which brings me to my market basket this
week. All right. I love the transition there, Joey.
You know what I have been loving this week and for the past several months?
What?
And I'm not sure when I'm going to stop seeing it. Rainbow chard. Or is it chard?
I think
it's... Is it chard?
I think it's chard. I call it chard.
But I say it wrong all the time.
That's okay.
Anyway, it's just the most... First of all, it's the prettiest vegetable.
It is so pretty.
The stems and all the... It's like the peacock of the vegetable world. For a long time, I struggled with loving it because I didn't realize that the stems and the leaves are like two separate vegetables.
Yeah. As soon as you embrace that, it opens up worlds.
So now when I get it, I immediately cut the stems out and dice them, and then I put the leaves separately.
Mm-hmm.
And I have been enjoying it in my eggs. Now almost I can't consider my eggs ideal if I don't have the Swiss chard in them. But I also do use them in tacos. Uh-huh. Back to our – I'd love like a greens tacos with maybe a few pinto beans or black beans
That's
in it.
Good.
Is this a favorite veggie of yours as well?
It is. I use rainbow chard or even plain chard, but rainbow is so much prettier all year round. It's one of my favorites for I often add the leaves – and the stems to like a big batch of chili. And I think I've talked about my chili before.
The hippie chili.
My hippie chili. My hippie turkey chili. I will saute up the stems with like the onions and garlic and then chop the leaves real fine and add them at the end. I also love to pickle the stems. They make a really good crunchy pickle. One of the things I've done in the past is I like to steam the leaves and then wrap things in them. So instead of like doing a cabbage roll, I'll do a Swiss chard roll sometimes.
Smart.
Which is really good. And generally, I just use them anywhere that I would use any other leafy green vegetables.
It's like spinach, but
yeah,
better.
It is. It is. I sometimes I'll make spinach. Well, it is because it doesn't cook down as much. You get more sort of finished cooked matter from Swiss chard than you do from the spinach. It just melts into nothing. And so I love to, when I have a really busy week coming up, I will make egg cups for the week, like on Sunday, where I'll make little like individual baked egg quiche things. So I'll, saute up a bunch of vegetables, divide them between some muffin tins, and then add beaten eggs and cheese and bake them off.
So how do you keep them from sticking to the muffin tins?
I have a nonstick muffin tin. Oh. I have a jumbo nonstick muffin tin.
Mine
that I
is
only...
supposedly nonstick, but they stick. I've tried that.
Yeah, they're if you bake them in anything else, they stick. But it's funny. It's not a muffin tin I ever would have bought, but Scott Kate brought it with him to our marriage, and it is
wow.
One of the. There are a couple of things he brought with him to our partnership that I use all the time. That it's a jumbo sized nonstick.
I'm
muffin
surprised
tin.
It's retained its nonstick properties.
I know
for
it's
all
been going
these
for
time.
Like I mean. Yeah, it's we've been together for 8 years and it's been going all that time and
wow.
He had it before that, so it's
impressive.
A decade old. I'm very careful with it. I try not to scrub the nonstickness off. But anyway, I love those egg cups and I will use Swiss chard in those a lot because it's filling and you get a lot of sort of bulk and vegetable and fiber in those egg cups and it's just good.
Agreed.
Yes. All hail the mighty rainbow chard.
Today we're talking with Alexis Siemens, who is a freelance tea writer, blogger, and tea consultant who lives in the New Jersey suburbs near Philadelphia. And we're here to talk about tea, how to use it, how to cook with it, and just hear a little bit about how Alexis got into tea. So welcome, Alexis.
Thank you for having me. I'm really excited.
Oh, I'm so glad you could be here. So tell us a little bit about how you got interested in tea to start.
Sure. So about 7 years ago, I was looking for a topic to blog about, and I actually started a blog about my life in general and realized that it was a terrible mistake and boring, and I didn't really find it interesting. And one day I was walking by Premium Steep Tea House. And I'd always been interested in tea. Growing up, I would drink a lot of green ginger tea. And I wanted to learn more about it. So I started a blog as a way of almost allowing myself the time to learn about tea. And in turn, all of these tea companies from around the world just started sending me literature and tea. And it just started from there, and I applied my background in writing and marketing and started to work with tea clients, so eventually evolved from a blog into a business and still a blog.
That's so fun. So what is your favorite thing about tea?
It's the ritual that it allows in your day-to-day life. So the idea that in the morning I always have that moment to look forward to, of having that cup of tea and having that 10 minutes to myself, and the idea of being able to then share that ritual with friends.
Do you have a particular favorite variety?
I tend to drink a lot of Taiwanese oolong teas. That is probably the one type of tea. And then if I had to pick a second, probably Japanese green teas. Those are the two categories that I tend to spend way too much money in.
So for those of us who think of tea as simply something that you drink,
right?
Can you tell us a little bit about the other applications for tea? How else you see tea playing a role in the culinary world and cuisine?
Sure. So I was excited a few years ago to start seeing it pop up in a lot of cocktails. So you definitely saw your Earl Grey and bourbon. You would see your green teas. Now you'll see a lot of matcha green tea in cocktails. But beyond that, I love cooking with it. I think that there are so many applications, of course, we're used to the sweets and the scones associated with afternoon tea. But the fact that it can be limitless and just treating it like a spice, or treating it like basically kind of an ingredient that you would infuse, whether it's making a simple tea butter all the way up to making a rub to using as a poaching liquid, I have yet to find a way that I can't use it when cooking.
That's really fun. So I know that you have a cookbook that's self-published, or a journal?
Journal, yes.
Do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. So a way to kind of share my love for cooking with tea, I decided to create a series of quarterly journals on cooking with tea. So the idea is they're self-printed, self-published mini journals. Mm-hmm. They're about the size of a tea saucer. I wanted to kind of keep that important in terms of the tea ritual and the size and scope of the tools. And each journal will probably have around 11 recipes. They have original photos. They have stories associated it, whether it's head notes describing tips or what inspired me to create the recipe, maybe substitutions. But I was just really looking forward to having something tangible that I could hold and share and create every season. So I launched the first issue, the summer one, in August, and I'm in the process of finishing the fall one, and I'm learning how much time it takes to create something from scratch. But it's been an incredible process, just learning from development of recipes to photography to putting it together to printing to marketing, and even down to packaging. So each is wrapped in a vintage handkerchief. So it's kind of that sustainable notion, but also back to the idea of a tea ritual. So I use a lot of handkerchiefs when I have tea in terms of a placemat. So I wanted to kind of extend that to the person who purchases the cookbook. So here's hoping I'll be finished the fall one soon.
And what is it called?
The name of the journal is With Tea. So everything is with tea. I tend to sign some of my emails with tea. So I figured I would keep it in that regard. And basically the idea is you can cook anything with tea. So I wanted to make that the title.
And when, if people are interested in that, can they find it through your website?
Sure. Yep. Just visit teaspoonsandpetals.com. And there's a little button at the top that says shop, and there's also a little picture of it on the left side.
Oh, very cool. So why don't you, you mentioned ritual a few times. Do you want to tell us about your morning tea ritual?
Sure. I think every morning that I wake up, and I try to make it a little bit earlier and earlier, especially in the fall, I love being able to wake up, pick out which tea I want, opening the cabinets and selecting. I try to vary it every day. But I do tend to start with more delicate teas in the morning because my palate has not been obliterated by a series of spices or butters. I pick something a little bit more special in the morning, heat the water, head outside if it's appropriate weather. Just give myself that 10 minutes, no phone. If I'm outside, just drinking the tea and observing nature, or if I'm inside, maybe it's reading a book that I really want to read for 10 minutes, but just paying attention, not walking away when the tea is brewing, looking at the leaves, the aroma. I think that's something that's really interesting with the tea process is there. It's not just drinking the tea, but it's smelling the leaves before they're brewed, after they're brewed, the aroma of the tea. All of those play a part in the sensory experience. So if you can just really curb and isolate those 10 minutes of time where you're not running to check the laundry or email and just focus, you'll appreciate the flavor so much more.
I love that. It makes me think that I don't spend nearly enough time with my morning beverage. I just sort of blindly brew, but I think maybe tomorrow I'll try to take a little more time. And
You can't do it every morning.
Yeah.
I will say I try to do it every morning, mm-hmm. but there are definitely those mornings when you can't afford it, and that's understandable. And then I just try to make sure I do it in the afternoon, or I always have a cold brew tea lingering in the fridge. So if it needs to be a grab and go situation, it's something I still enjoy.
You want to tell us a little bit more about your cold brew teas?
Yes. I really love cold brewing oolong teas. Uh-huh. So you really can cold brew any tea. I just find that whether it's a black tea or a green tea, I find that oolong teas work really well because they're so complex and they're intended to be steeped anywhere between 3 to 7 times the same leaves.
Wow.
So by cold brewing it for a longer period of time, you're allowing the leaves to extract all of those complex flavors that might take 3 to 7 with hot water. And I just think it develops just a really unique flavor that is different from just brewing the tea hot and chilling it over ice. Mm-hmm. And there are so many different ways. I just experimented with another way the other day. It's a Japanese method called shinobi cha, and it sort of translates to ninja tea, but I was talking with someone about that, and you don't really... It's something with the Japanese character. I think it has to do with the idea of it being patient and stealth, because basically what you're doing is it works really well with a special kind of Japanese green tea called gyokuru, and you just add green tea leaves dry to your teapot or even a bowl, cover the dry tea leaves with ice cubes, and just let them naturally melt in your ambient temperature. I think it took like around 2 hours for me. This was in the summer when I did that, and it created this tiny little shot of concentrated green tea. I mean, you only want a shot of it because it's so powerful. but this particular tea, it's high in L-theanine amino acid, which lends itself to the sweetness and the umami flavors of green tea. So it extracts all of that, but it doesn't extract a lot of the tannins mm-hmm. and the caffeine and the catechins that kind of give a little bit of the bitter astringent. So it's super savory. It's almost like a sea salt. And then it ends with this like sugarcane sweetness. It was unlike anything I'd tried before. So I want to try it with some other teas. But
that sounds so interesting.
It's fun just to have next to you. I mean, really, it's like all you have to do is put ice on tea and just watch it melt. But you definitely test your patience as you're literally waiting for ice to melt.
That's too funny. That's fascinating. It would never even occur to me to do that, but it makes sense because it's sort of this slow infusion of water.
Exactly.
So.
And if you have a fancy fancy gravity pot, but I tend to like just throwing ice cubes in a bowl over some tea and letting the magic happen.
And so for just the regular cold brew, you're just combining tea and water and popping in the refrigerator?
Basically, and I like to experiment with different ratios. I tend to like my tea a little bit stronger, so I do a tablespoon per 8 ounces of water.
Okay.
Some people, I'd say start with a teaspoon. Start checking it around 4 hours if you're doing it during the day, depending on the tea. Anytime between 4 and 8 hours. Okay. After that, it's going to start to become a little overbrewed.
And for that cold brew, can you reuse those leaves again?
I do.
Do you?
I brew until I'm left with basically water. So I extract as much as I can. You wouldn't want to leave the leaves out in between. You would just want to keep adding water to them and popping them back in. And just testing it. It's fun to play with it. You can even, if you're starting to get a little bored, you can add some herbs and some fruit. I've added some peaches and mint to my tea.
That sounds so good.
The water and let the infusion magic happen.
How fun. So can you tell us a little bit about where you think tea is going in the future?
Sure. Well, I would say within the past year, thanks to matcha green tea, I've seen a huge interest in specialty tea. So I see people kind of stepping further away from the traditional black tea bags that they've grown up with and exploring specialty teas. So whether it's, you know, oolong teas from Taiwan or green teas. And I credit that a lot to cafes, especially in New York and San Francisco. Those are the two cities I look to for tea.
Yeah.
To see, you know, there are a tremendous amount of cafes in both cities now just dedicated to tea. There are at least two cafes in New York just dedicated to matcha green tea. So it's like a specific focus of a tea. And I'm starting to see restaurants in both New York and San Francisco not only have it on their menu, but have really strategically picked certain teas that pair well with their cuisine. So it's not an afterthought of your typical Earl Grey and chamomile. There's a restaurant in San Francisco that now is offering a tea pairing menu for their food. So I think you'll see more and more restaurants. Here's hoping. Philadelphia, listen up.
Is there anybody in Philadelphia who's doing that right now?
Not that I'm aware of. I mean, there are people that have some good tea from local tea shops. I would say, please, Philadelphia, this is my plea. Please offer good tea. It could be, you know, I'm not expecting someone to have 10 teas. I think it would be a disservice because that really requires the staff to know a lot about water temperature and steep time. And I think just have one or two really good teas. Just make sure you brew them well. Because I think if you're a little too overambitious, it, you could ruin the experience.
Yeah.
I've seen cocktails. I've seen some cooking with tea. And I think chefs are excited about just using it as an ingredient. So I see it slowly creeping into more and more specialty cafes and just the amount of interest popping up.
So last question.
Yes.
As we head into fall, can you recommend one really great tea for people to be brewing as, you know, as the days get shorter and the weather gets cooler?
Okay. So I really like, it's an oolong tea. It's Oriental Beauty.
Mm-hmm.
It tends to have stone fruit notes and woodsy kind of aromas. So it's kind of captures that like click from summer into fall, but it definitely is on the darker side of oolong teas. I think that one is really good. I'd have to just give two more. One, I can never pick.
That's okay.
One great one is roasted Japanese green tea. It's called hojicha.
Mm-hmm.
It is known to be low in caffeine, which is good for evenings. But for those people familiar with the smoked tea, Lapsang Souchong, that's super smoked. It's almost like inhaling a campfire. This one is much more mild. It's more nutty and roasted.
Mm-hmm.
And it pairs really well with fish.
Oh.
So if you're cooking along those lines, but there are so many. But those are the two I definitely kind of lean to when fall starts because they capture that kind of roasted woodsy honey aromas.
I love it. They sound terrific. Well, Alexis, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's our pleasure. And you can find more of Alexis's writing, her journal, and recipes for using tea on her website, teaspoonandpetals.com, right? Teaspoonsandpetals.com.
Perfect.
Great. Thanks, Alexis.
Thank you.
That about does it.
Our thanks go out to Dan Call for editing the show and to Raina Rose for providing the music. And thank you guys for listening. If you like what you hear, make sure to subscribe via iTunes or your favorite podcasting app. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Local Mouthful. You can also sign up for our newsletter and catch up on all of our episodes and show notes at localmouthful.com. And this week we'll make sure to post a picture of that crazy voluptuous olive oil bottle. Until next time, happy eating!